491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to New York Island. Redwood forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. It's episode 308, and we're recording this on May 17th, 2020. Joining me, as usual, on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Hi, Bill. I'm doing well.
So, Rachel, we're continuing our series on the early U.S. oil industry in the United States. We've been talking about the Pennsylvania oil rush, the rise of Standard Oil, and the railroad rate wars on the past three episodes. And last week, we asked folks to be keeping in mind some of the modern parallels that might come to mind. And next week, we're going to be drilling down more specifically on the modern parallels to things that we're seeing in, you know, the tech industry and so forth. But we are going to be focusing our discussion this week specifically on the Gilded Age. You know, again, I think a lot of people thinking of the current period as the second Gilded Age. This is the first, the original OG Gilded Age, and the concurrent with the second Industrial Revolution. And part of the case is obviously, you know, that the second Industrial Revolution leads directly to this notion of the Gilded Age, which, again, it's gilded for the people at the very top, not for the rest of the people. The reason it's a Gilded Age as opposed to a Golden Age is explicitly to make the case that it was a very superficial prosperity because, of course, as we alluded to last week, there were repeated market crashes, significant poverty, wage cuts that were happening in this period and so forth. But as I said, we're going to talk this week about the Second Industrial Revolution, and specifically we're going to contemplate two important questions. What role did the large formations of capital play in the industrial activities that were going on? In other words, not just looking at the consolidation of these industries in the abstract, but saying, was the consolidation a natural outcome of not just, you know, capitalism in an abstract way, but literally in order to make these industries work, did they have to be consolidated, and that required significant amounts of money and investment and so forth? Number two, the issue of, is it possible to have a monopoly that is not bad? And specifically what we mean there is, as we've talked about on past episodes, in particular, you can refer back to episode 270 from last May, also our, as we'll talk about in a minute, our episode on the IWW, or our episodes on the IWW that we recorded in 2019. There are sort of two schools of thought on monopolism in the United States and various other countries, and the dominant one for quite some time has been that monopolies are bad and must be broken up. And there is a counter case to be made from the left that there is a different way of doing monopolies, right? You could have a state monopoly, you could have a worker monopoly. So we'll talk about that as well as we go in this discussion. Now, again, next week, we're going to talk again about modern parallels, more specifically to the early oil industry and the railroads around it. But mostly this week, we're going to be focusing again on this specific period of the 1870s. And obviously, we'll talk a little bit about some of the things that happened subsequent to that. But this is the early sort of nucleus of a lot of the things that panned out later. This is the origins, as I said, of the Gilded Age. So the question again becomes, are monopolies necessary to doing the economic activity that's being considered in this period, as opposed to the first industrial revolution, where you have the beginnings of, you know, a few guys that have some extra money get together and they form a corporation and then they buy a piece of mining equipment or something like that, or maybe they buy a loom, or maybe they, you know, buy some farm equipment, and then you'd scale it up and have a factory, or you'd have a plantation or whatever, because of course plantations was sort of the factory equivalent of doing agriculture in this period, in the earlier period, in the late 18th century, early 19th century. But we're talking now about the second industrial revolution, the rise of these huge, powerful corporations doing very capital intensive activities. We talked a lot last week about the railroads in particular and how much enormous amounts of capital were required to build all of that infrastructure out. The previous week, we talked about the rise of Standard Oil and all of the investments that Rockefeller made to consolidate the oil industry and improve the oil industry from its sort of wildcat origins that we had talked about in episode one. So, Rachel, I think we might want to start by talking about going back to our episodes last year about the IWW, looking back in the early 1900s on what had developed, and again, their counter argument to the progressive response. And we'll get into the progressive response in just a minute. But I think there is an importance today to this conversation, right? Because that was the episode that you had done on the show last year in 2019 regarding Elizabeth Warren's proposals on her presidential campaign, and the former Facebook guy, you know, who was saying, well, I don't necessarily have a problem with Mark Zuckerberg personally, but, you know, no one man should have all that power type of thing. And talking about, you know, how much power he has over Facebook and how much power Facebook has over, like, politics and the economy and stuff. But what is the sort of modern reason that we have to be thinking about this, Rachel?
Well, I think, as we've mentioned before, like, private capital owners have been able to call the shots and call the winners and the losers by any means necessary, either by just actually stifling the competition or just buying it outright. The thing that the IWW was kind of talking about is the worker monopoly. So the workers...
Which would be contrasted with something like, you know, with the Elizabeth Warren direction.
Right. So rather than breaking up these companies, which I think as we talk about what happened to Standard Oil, it isn't always as effective as I think the trust bust cheerleaders seem to think it is. So in the worker monopoly, the workers are able to come together and control the supply chain. So we're talking about vertical integration. So these workers are coming together to control every step in the supply chain and the production cycle, versus these private corporations being able to buy their competition and start also attempting to vertically integrate and kind of take control of the supply chain. And if the workers are able to do this, they can help govern for the benefit of the workers. Whereas I think, as we talked about, as you mentioned earlier, the winner in the monopoly of Standard Oil was Rockefeller and a few of his cronies. The oil producers themselves and the workers didn't really get much benefit out of this It was the owners and the stockholders, basically. Whereas with the worker monopoly, it's the workers that benefit and are able to call the shots. So it's just for the benefit of more people.
Yeah, so as we talked about on the episode where we did the super long double episode on American syndicalism and the IWW and various sort of anarchist tendencies in the United States and revolutionary trade unionism, in the 1967 book by Patrick Renshaw called The Wobblies, The Story of Syndicalism, as I talked about on that episode, he analogizes the syndicalist character of industrial unions forming around the giant industrial cartel and monopoly corporations to represent all the different types of workers in the supply chain and production cycle as akin to a shadow government except for the entire economy. Basically, if the industrial unions were able to take control of the vertically integrated supply chains of the increasingly horizontally monopolized private corporations, they would have replaced the entire capitalist system and rendered the political state irrelevant. Its industrial departments were to act as syndicalist shadows of American capitalism so that after the revolution, they could quickly step in and help govern the workers' commonwealth, end quote. And the comparison that I made in that episode was that, you know, if you look today, a company like Amazon, you know, they acquired Whole Foods, so now they're in that industry. And then, you know, they're obviously very keen on avoiding the consolidation and of workers. We saw that happen in those manipulations happen in the same period that we're talking about in the late 19th century, right? You'd have the various unions within a railroad competing with each other until people like Eugene Debs came along and said, you know, that you had to unite them all into one union. That was the one big union philosophy of the IWW. And so in a modern example, the question is like, do you say that the problem is Amazon owning Whole Foods and try to break them up again? Or do you try to figure out a way of having the workers and the people control a corporation that is integrated in such a manner? And again, the IWW and those folks at the turn of the last century were arguing that the trust-busting response had failed. Obviously, as I said at the episode when we were talking about that, this objective that they had, this idea of like, oh, all we have to do is take over these monopolies and, for the workers and then everything will be fine. Like, well, that didn't happen because the same problem that we're having now where they spent a lot of time union busting, right? And figuring out ways to avoid unions consolidating within their enterprises. And so that, you know, didn't work. But the other comparison that, you know, and the contrast point that Renshaw makes, which I think is important to understand, given that the progressive movement emerges as one response, not from the worker side, particularly in as a response to this, the problems of this emerging out of the Second Industrial Revolution in, let's say, like the 1890s or even 1880s. They turned to trust-busting legislation to try to break those emerging cartels. And as Renshaw notes, by the time that President Hoover took office in 1929, there was more control over the entire U.S. economy by these, you know, giant cartel monopoly-type corporations and entities than there had been at the end of the 19th century. So obviously, you know, the IWW was not successful in their approach either, but it's clear that the progressive approach of trust busting failed. The IWW's formation in 1905 was in no small part an attempt to seek a more permanent syndicalist fix to the problem by organizing every single American worker into a single union that could not be played off another union at the same company and which could eventually be positioned to take worker control of a given corporation away from whatever family or individual controlled it again. That didn't pan out, but that was the hope. A workers' monopoly to defeat the capitalist corporate monopolies. Renshaw calls this dual purpose, quote, both the embryo of the new society and the revolutionary instrument for achieving it, end quote. And this was to be done through, quote, a series of strikes leading to a general strike which would force the capitalists to capitulate, end quote. But again, while that didn't really work out either, that was also never really attempted on any significant scale. But let's talk more specifically now about the progressives, because again, as I keep alluding to in that episode that Rachel did with us for us last year, In May of 2019, which actually probably about exactly a year ago, I think, you were talking about how there seemed to be, again, this resurgence of saying, of people saying, like, all of our problems will be solved if we just bring back the trust busting. And before we were recording, Rachel, you and I were talking about, like, how, you know, very memorable the cartoons would be of like Teddy Roosevelt and people like that trust busting, right? That was like a real, like, they tried to come up with sort of like a grassroots push that, like, this is what the people want. You know, and understandably, as we talked about with the Ida Tarbell book on Standard Oil, like, people were mad about Standard Oil from the very beginning. Like, as soon as he started putting his machinations into place, within a matter of months, there were already investigations happening and people were upset about it. But it seems like this is coming back into vogue again as like, oh, this will solve all of our problems, and the only, you know, problem that we have is the consolidation of these corporations. Am I off base on that? That's the kind of the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah, I think there's been a just kind of a blanket call from I guess self-proclaimed progressives that we just need to break up Facebook. We just need to break up Google or Apple or Amazon, and it'll all be peachy. But I don't think the history has borne that out. Just if you look at things like Standard Oil or like Bell Communications, there's no real evidence that the effects of trust busting are long lasting at all.
I mean, I think there's probably, as with anything, right, there's like a few notable outliers in terms of, like, for example, the Glass-Steagall provision of breaking apart investment banks from banks that do like local lending and home mortgages and stuff like that. That is obviously an important partition to make. But that's not as much of a partition of saying, like, oh, we need to have like more market competition and that will solve all of our problems, right? That's not the purpose of breaking that up. That's a different type of breakup being undertaken. The idea that, as you said, that, oh, if we just break up this corporation and have more market competition, like, I think that's, you know, the underlying logic of things like the Affordable Care Act as well, with the market exchanges. And one of the things that was criticized when that was in the drafting process was, if you have a state where 90% of the people are on Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, how does introducing quote unquote market competition, especially without a public option competing with it, how does that possibly introduce competition? And you know, even in Massachusetts, what we end up with is, and that's one of the more sort of highly regulated and subsidized exchanges, the plans that are offered between the three or however many, four maybe companies that are on the exchange, depending on what level you're at, are pretty much the same. And there's not much of a price difference between them because it's so strictly regulated anyway. And there's all kinds of, like, you know, edicts from the state about how things should be done. But, like, for the most part, and we saw this certainly with Standard Oil, and I think, you know, we're not going to get into the Ma Bell stuff just because it's well outside of the scope of what we're talking about here. But, you know, with Standard Oil, it seems like this just didn't really do anything. Like, what was the point of breaking it up? I mean, it made Rockefeller rich, but that wasn't really the intention of it. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Rachel?
Right. So in the Supreme Court case, U.S. Supreme Court case, Standard Oil Company of New Jersey v. United States, the Supreme Court did find that Standard Oil of New Jersey was guilty of monopolizing the petroleum industry through a series of abusive and anti-competitive actions. And I think this decision came out in 1911. So Standard Oil had like a 40-year head start, basically, before they kind of got slapped down by the courts. And the court's remedy was to divide Standard Oil into several geographically separate and eventually competing firms, 34 of them. But I think the key point is this geographically separate. So like you said about the ACA exchanges, if they're geographically separate, they can basically just control their corner of the country and not really have any competition from these broken up firms. So I don't think it actually had the effect that they were anticipating. And today, those 34 companies have now, through mergers, are now down to 4 companies. So the big names, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Marathon Petroleum, and BP. So we're kind of back where we started. And like you said, all it really seemed to do was make Rockefeller the richest man in the world through his shareholdings. The value just skyrocketed with the breakup of Standard Oil. So it didn't, I don't think it really had the effect that it was meant to have, which is to scare off other corporations that are attempting to do the same thing.
Now, as you said, it did take a while for them to actually get to this Supreme Court decision, although there had been various investigations and public pressure for many years. We did allude last time to the fact that in the by the mid-1880s, there was the creation of the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was more specifically to deal with some of the railroad issues we were talking about last week. But again, that was relatively toothless. Then you get the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. That was relatively weak, with one key exception we're about to talk about. And then they had to revise it later. And then eventually you do get to that, you know, in the early 19 teens, you get to that decision breaking up Standard Oil. So it certainly took a while. But again, this whole time, there's this push from both the progressives and the self-styled free traders. That was something that comes up in the Tarbell book on Standard Oil quite a lot, you know, and this is the book that we were talking about a lot in the first two episodes of the series. But the free traders, again, sort of the genesis there, which then evolves into this progressive movement position, is that, again, all of our problems will be solved if we just have more competition in the market. Now, is that compatible with the information that we have heard and discussed over the last three episodes, Rachel? Is that view that competition in the marketplace is what would have made these industries better than they were?
No, because one of the themes that we kind of touched on with both the railroads and the oil producers and refiners is that competition actually created a lot of inefficiencies, and it actually created volatile markets. There was these boom and bust cycles that swung wildly, and speculation and leveraging debt, like we talked about. So the competition didn't really, it wasn't the end all be all that the free market proponents like to claim it is. It just created a lot of uncertainty, basically.
And while Rockefeller was taking the heat for his bullying and buying of his rivals, and for horizontal competition, and then subsequently he started buying, as we talked about, the vertical integration of the supply chain components for the oil industry. At the very early stages, we see two things emerge at the same time, partly in large part reaction to his activities from the oil producers and from the railroads. And it was not particularly in the direction of competition, and not for nefarious reasons, right?
As we kind of talked about last week, these like low and unstable prices of crude oil were a big problem for the producers. I think there was just so much pumping going on that there was like an overcapacity that the refiners couldn't handle. And then once they got a handle on it, the refinery capacity was more than the pumping capacity. So it just created this untenable situation where the producers or the refiners had to kind of start controlling the supply of their products, because the prices were just going so low. There were just these producers and refiners were just undercutting each other, and it was basically a race to the bottom. So I believe the Producers Association had to kind of come together and start saying, like, hey, we need to start reducing the supply of crude oil because it's unsustainable. We're just not making a profit. So we have to collectively come together and decide how we're going to control the production of crude oil.
It's like all these free trade advocates in the oil fields had to form a cartel in order for their industry to function.
Yes, they had to come together and learn how, and actually, yeah, like there had to be controls in place to make it so anyone could succeed.
And then the railroads also similarly dealing with the undercutting price rate wars that we talked about so extensively on our railroads episode last week. What was their response to this situation? Also cartels, right?
Yes. They had to create these pools where they actually had to split out who was shipping what and what percentage of the freight market they could control. So yeah, it did become a kind of a tightly controlled situation, because otherwise nobody was making any profit. And I think some people were running at an actual loss. So it just was this unsustainable situation that had to get resolved.
Well, actually, to be specific, though, as we talked about last week, it wasn't just that they weren't making a profit or that they weren't making enough money to pay off the debts. In some cases, they were literally operating rail lines and freight shipments and passenger traffic below the cost that it took to even just operate that shipment.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
exactly.
Passenger is always unprofitable. We can get into that. But like the whole thing with the freight is like, the entire reason for existence is that you're a business that exists to ship freight. If it costs you more to ship the freight than you get paid to ship the freight, without even accounting for profits and debt payments, that's a huge problem. And so the issue is, like, even from the very beginning, Rockefeller, the railroad executives, the producers, all of them were constantly in public sort of propaganda battles, trying to convince the public that that their particular cartel arrangements were necessary to benefit the public good. And here's the thing about that. Based on what we've talked about on the last several episodes, is it untrue that it was actually necessary in many cases for them to consolidate their industries in order to benefit the public? I mean, that's the part, right? Like, you can write it off, as I think the progressives maybe overly foolishly did, of saying like, oh, these guys just want to restrain competition in the market. You know, this is against our common law principles, etc. That was something that the U.S. Senate said when they were passing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890. They said basically, this is just, you know, applying the principles of common law. And that was the same problem that the railroads were encountering, right? They were illegally, or kind of not really legally, giving these rebates to preferred shippers like Rockefeller. That's how he was able to, you know, beat out his competition initially and get enough of an edge to be able to consolidate. Was that he was getting these you know, rebate deals where they would give him a price cut on the back end of things after the shipment had gone through. And this was, you know, the people who were promoting free trade within the country were horrified by this, because they were like, well, the common law principles say that the carriers, these are public carriers, essentially, right? They're private companies, but they're public carriers, that any businessman should be able to ship his goods over these railroads for the same price. And that's, you know, just a matter of principle of common law. And that was the whole thing with Sherman Antitrust. They said that this was against the restraint of the market, essentially, right? That you know, unfair practices, this is restraining the market, and this is therefore bad for the consumers. That is the progressive movement's continual pitch, both in the 1890s and present day, is saying all we have to do is break up these corporations and everything will be fine. There will be market competition, and necessarily, and this is what you get also allegedly, I don't think they actually believe it in most cases, but you get all the like libertarian type conservatives insisting that all problems will be solved as long as there's market competition, because competition drives down the prices. And one of the things that Rockefeller said quite early, and you can say, oh, he had an ulterior motive, but the question again is, was he wrong in saying it? Was that the huge price volatility often meant that the consumers weren't actually getting any benefits of prices going down, because when the price would go down, the companies would just, on the, you know, dealing with the consumer side of the business, would just not lower the prices. They'd just pocket the difference. And then when the prices went way up in terms of the crude oil you know, prices that drove up all the production prices and everything and the refining prices and all that, they would just raise the price on the consumers. The volatility was not beneficial to the consumers, and they were saying, yeah, we're going to charge slightly more, but in exchange, you're going to get this more stability. Now, again, I'm not getting into whether or not that actually panned out because that was mostly propaganda, but you saw the same thing from the rail executives, right? They're saying, well, look, we've got this competition from the Erie Canal anyway, so that's going to kind of put a limit on, you know, how much we can jack up the price. But also, we have to operate at a cost, like we have to be able to charge enough in freight costs that we are able to make money on a given shipment. And that it's not good for the customers if the railroads all go bankrupt because they're not charging enough money and they can't. You can criticize them and say, oh, well, they were also, you know, paying all these like exorbitant interest payments on things, or they were paying all these dividends, they're paying off their shareholders, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Those are valid criticisms because we're not here to defend the idea of private capitalist owned monopolies. But there is a case to be made here that there were some reasons other than just, oh, a capitalist guy wants to become a tycoon and consolidate the entire industry. There were some legitimate reasons why one of the biggest features of the Second Industrial Revolution, as opposed to the First Industrial Revolution, which legitimately was a bunch of guys like sitting around trying to figure out what to do, like, hey, what if we put a steam engine on it, right? Like, that was the kind of thing that most industries were doing at that in the First Industrial Revolution, was actual experimentation and innovation. The Second Industrial Revolution, mostly it was established technology, and at that point, you're trying to figure out, how do I make this a more stable industry and a obviously, from their perspective, a profitable industry, but in the more most literal, narrowest sense, how do we make this cost less to do so that we can make things more efficient? Again, from their perspective, they're trying to make things more efficient so that a guy like Rockefeller and his cronies, as Rachel said, make all of the money off of this, right? They're the beneficiaries of this. But the leftist case, as opposed to the progressive case, is saying there is a reason to do this consolidation because it actually is better for the industry. It is more efficient. You get the economies of scale, etc. There is a logical reason why the Second Industrial Revolution is characterized by the consolidation of industries into these very concentrated formations. And I think that that's often elided now and historically by the progressive movement. The idea that, oh, if we just break up everything and have all this market competition, the prices are going to go down, is not necessarily true. What we see right now, despite the fact that the oil industry is obviously relatively heavily consolidated, on the production side, there are still a bunch of producers, especially smaller producers in the United States, who are grappling with, you know, or at least several weeks ago when we started the series, they were grappling with the production boosts from places like Saudi Arabia, which was doing basically a price war with Russia and so forth. And they're looking at that and saying, well, I guess I should keep my oil well running because it's a huge, huge expense to restart it if I cap it. So I'll just take the hit on these low prices. And eventually, for the first time in world history, in U.S. history, crude oil prices went into the negative. That wasn't something that even happened in the early Pennsylvania oil rush. And the prices did get almost to zero at certain points with overproduction and so forth. You get into a situation where you have a bunch of smaller producers who are not really going along with what the bigger producers are saying. But the bigger producers can float more, you know, money and capital investments. And that's the other huge thing, is that every time that somebody like Rockefeller got a slight edge over the competition, they could use that immediately to consolidate everything horizontally or vertically or whatever over each other, because they then had that extra capital boost. But the other thing is that what the thing that kept emerging in the Ida Tarbell book in the early chapters, especially on the Pennsylvania oil rush, is that the mythology is, oh, it's just some dude doing a wildcat oil drilling operation in northwestern Pennsylvania. And that's not really the story. The story is the giant influx of capital from places like New York, from Wall Street, into making major investments into the industry, standardizing things, buying the necessary equipment, etc. That's what the Second Industrial Revolution was all about, was these giant consolidations of production in the oil business, in the steel business, in the coal business, and so forth. And then, of course, they start buying the different pieces of the supply chain so that they can reduce their own costs. That was something that people like Rockefeller did, and he was not alone in that, although he was certainly one of the most important pioneers of that. And again, the question here is, well, is the problem the integration, or is the problem who is doing the integration, who benefits, and who owns it?
I wanted to kind of point out that there was an example in the Ida Tarbell book where the independent producers were just trying to wait out Rockefeller, and they thought they could. Like, I think initially spirits were high, but then like you said, the smaller producers just cannot maintain that lack of production. So at that point, Rockefeller had all the cards on his side. He could wait as long as necessary to put the independent producers out of business, because he could cap his wells and his refineries, and it wouldn't really be a problem for him because he had all the capital that he could survive on for months at a time, whereas the independent producers and the independent refiners just couldn't handle that. After a month, they started getting kind of antsy and were talking about how they had to actually start up their production again. And so the independent association could only last so long against the behemoth that was Rockefeller and the amount of capital that he could control to kind of ride out these highs and lows.
Now, one of the big things that we talked about last week was the Panic of 1873 and the effect that that had on the railroad industry. Again, we are not in favor of capitalist monopolies. We are trying to separate the concept of monopoly from the capitalists, the speculators, and the big time, big money investors in places like Wall Street or wherever. One of the problems that the railroad industry faced in the late 1860s, leading to the 1873 panic, was that you had too much money floating around. Well, that's a familiar phenomenon to what we're seeing today. You had too much money floating around from the big time capital guys who were willing to finance the creation of excessive mileage of railroads. And you might say, well, that's an absurd concept. You know, how do you define excessive? But again, if we're talking about a situation where in some parts of the country you had the prices going so low due to competition in a given regional area that they could no longer operate at even the cost of operating the shipment, and we talked about some of those prices of how low it ended up dropping at certain points to ship a bushel of grain from Chicago to New York, whether by Erie Canal or by the trains, there was so much capital flooding in that they were excessively overbuilding. We even talked about a scheme where some guys that were basically confidence men built an entire railroad with the sole purpose of having it go bankrupt as soon as it opened so that the New York Central would be forced to buy it because it was running along next to the tracks that they owned, literally like right next to their tracks in some cases. And that would be an unacceptable form of undercutting competition. We also talked last week about the way that companies in receivership in bankruptcy were able to undercut each other, undercut the railroads that weren't in receivership because they weren't paying off creditors and so forth. So again, there is a distinction to be made between the operation of something from the perspective of driving profits to a narrow class of capitalists, private capitalists, as opposed to operating it, you know, for the benefit of the workers or on behalf of the state as a state corporation, etc. But they ended up having the Panic of 1873 because there were so many of these railroads that were so overbuilt that there was just no possible traffic demand, especially in the West at that point, to sustain the level of construction that had been done, right? There was no way you could make enough returns for those shares and companies not to be worthless in many cases. A ton of those railroads, over 100 of those railroads, went bankrupt in that period. Now, we had already seen in the period before the Rockefeller era, you'd have the rail tycoons. You know, you could call it horizontal integration, but it wasn't really, right? Because yes, they would buy a whole bunch of railroads, but generally they were not railroads serving the same area. They were railroads that were serving in different areas. So you would have basically one guy owning a network where, okay, he owns a railroad in this state and it connects to the railroad in this state, and therefore you can run a train over both of them. But that's not the same as either buying the railroads in the same area or coming up with a revenue sharing cartel arrangement, as we saw emerge with the rise of Standard Oil, where you'd say all of the oil traffic and then all of the traffic in general by the mid to late 1870s in a given region, such as the state of Pennsylvania or the traffic between the Cleveland/Pittsburgh and New York/Philadelphia, you would split up in the percentages and say the railroads here will share this and so forth. It became very clear quickly that there were too many railroads relative to the level of demand for them, except in certain exceptional cases like, you know, boom in Civil War traffic or whatever. And this became such a problem that as early as the 1870s, there was consideration that there might need to be some sort of a government-backed consolidation. And in fact, as I alluded to last time, in other countries, the response to the Panic of 1873, which did affect other countries as well for similar reasons, was to nationalize the railroads. And that obviously didn't happen in the United States. What we ultimately see is that although there was this political pressure from the grassroots of saying the railroads are so unfair, they're charging too much, etc., what we also see is that the lack of standardization and excessive competition was more of a problem than it was helpful in many ways. And that is something that I think, again, it's more a question of who's running it and what their objectives of running it are than the existence of the monopoly itself. One of the things that is, you know, something we see today is a bunch of these tech companies trying to say like how innovative they are and talking about the necessity of having this marketplace so they can innovate. And of course, they don't really mean that. But we saw similar things with the railroad industry as well, right? The railroads in this 1870s period would constantly be talking about like the, you know, what innovations they were doing. But the issue is you have to weigh the benefits of innovation and differentiation in the market versus standardization of the market and economies of scale. And that is something that Standard Oil, we talked about, was intentionally trying to do. Rockefeller was explicitly trying to do with the oil industry. One of the reasons he called his company Standard Oil is because he was going to standardize the entire industry so there would be more compatibility, less differentiation within the market, right? This would be how you would, you know, make a certain product. This would be the machinery that you would use in the factories. And every time that he acquired a new factory, if it was being semi-independently operated, they would have to follow all kinds of regulations by Standard Oil on how it would be standardized. We saw similar challenges happening in the rail industry. Gauges of railroads was a particularly thorny one in this time period because there wasn't a standardized gauge. And in many cases, you would have situations where railroads would say, I don't want to standardize the gauge because then people will be able to run cars straight through from one side of my railroad to the other, whereas I can make more money by forcing them to offload their goods out of all the boxcars and put them into new boxcars on my tracks that are wider than their tracks or narrower than their tracks. And sometimes by a matter of inches in many cases. You also had railroads like the Erie Railroad explicitly saying, my passenger cars are wider than the competition's passenger cars, and that's more comfortable. It's kind of like airlines these days doing all those BS ads about their various leg rooms or whatever and how they're different from the other airlines. Again, at a certain point, it's all kind of flim-flammy, whatever nonsense that isn't really, like, in what way is that benefiting the consumer? That's the question, right? In what way is having all of this competition? This is not genuinely, like, innovative. Yeah, there's in the early period of railroads, in like the 1830s or 40s and 50s, yeah, they're just kind of experimenting around. But for the most part, there wasn't a huge amount of innovation happening. And again, the question is, why would you not just have one national rail network with standard gauges and so forth. Why is that not more helpful to the consumers and all the companies that depend on these railroads? There were a few outlier exceptions. For example, telegraph dispatching. That was something the Erie Railroad did early. Telegraph dispatching was basically, oh, if we run a telegraph wire the entire length of the railroad and we have a telegraph agent at every station, that obviously provides ways of speeding up the traffic and safely dispatching trains more effectively than had been previously done. And it has the added benefit of now providing telegraph service to all of these towns all over the country, or at least all over the service area of this particular company. But for the most part, I don't think this was like top of mind. I don't think they were sitting there being like, oh, well, this competitive market situation is allowing us to innovate in ways that are genuinely beneficial to the industry and really cutting edge, as opposed to we're finding a way to quote unquote innovate that just makes it so that we're incompatible with our fellow rival companies, and therefore you have to, you know, ship with us and establish brand loyalty or whatever. Again, I don't see that as being beneficial to the customer. The case is to be made, I think, and that was the story of the Second Industrial Revolution, is standardization, economies of scale. Obviously, we're talking about this in a pre-Taylorization era, where you standardize everything in your factory and change all the light bulbs at the same time and that kind of thing to save money. But we're seeing the early kernels of a lot of this stuff, where they say, hey, if we standardize this, if we build an economy of scale, we're going to get various advantages out of that.
That just kind of brought to mind the fact in the early days of cell phones, there were all these non-standard charging cables, and how if you got a new phone, you automatically had to get a new charging cable. And then once we kind of standardized that with micro USB or the USB-C, or I guess Apple kind of did their own thing. But then once it got more standardized, it did make it easier on the consumer versus this, like, quote unquote innovation, where all these companies were trying out these new things to kind of differentiate themselves. But on the consumer end, it was kind of a nightmare. You ended up with like five different kinds of cords, and they weren't compatible with anything else. So that just kind of popped into my head right now.
So again, kind of the upshot of all of this, the question to be thinking about, and again, next week we'll be going into some of those more modern parallels more explicitly, but the question to be thinking about as we're thinking about the early U.S. oil industry and the rail industry in the same time period is, and the Second Industrial Revolution as a whole, is this question of, is there an inherent reason that it's bad to have a monopoly, or is the question who owns it? And what are the objectives of the governance of the monopoly? And I think that is a really critical question that is under-examined as we're seeing a resurgence of this push by the progressive wing, not the leftists, the progressives, to say that all of our problems will be solved by breaking up these corporations. There's no evidence to suggest from the first wave of trust busting that this had any effect whatsoever on breaking up the power of these monopolies over both our economy and our government. It's very unclear that it worked for the most part, but it's also not clear that it's a good idea or useful. There are many reasons to see from the reason that these developed was not just, oh, by buying up all the industries around me, and by buying up all the components of the supply chain in my industry, that I can save a buck. There were reasons why this consolidation happened that go beyond that and go beyond the issue of private capitalists. Obviously, having dedicated capital and significant consolidated investments was clearly very important as well. But the question is, did it have to be private guys on Wall Street, or a guy like Rockefeller, in Cleveland, Ohio, who's privately as an individual or with a group of his buddies, coming up with everything, calling all the shots, etc.? No. But one of the reasons that the leftist alternative also never took off is because the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, and this is the final point to be making today, as you loop back to the IWW stuff at the beginning, the Sherman Act of 1890 As interpreted by the 1893 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, United States v. Working Man's Amalgamated Council of New Orleans, was to hold that the law applied to labor unions. Basically, they argued that labor unions were an unfair restraint of competitive marketplaces. If the workers formed one giant workers' monopoly, one big union, and they tried to negotiate, or even just a little bitty union for one particular industry, to try to negotiate on behalf of all the workers in that industry, that was an illegal restraint of the free market. And that was heavily enforced against the unions, much more than the law was enforced to actually break up the companies that they were negotiating against. That is one huge reason why the progressive alternative became the dominant one. In addition to, obviously, you could speculate that the progressive approach was more palatable than, say, revolutionary trade unionism to a lot of people, and it was an acceptable alternative to grapple with the problems of the Second Industrial Revolution, the Gilded Age, and the formation of monopolies. But this is important to understanding this, and it's a question that I want people to be thinking about is as they contemplate the role of capital in the consolidation of the industry and the necessary investments. Literally, again, you're buying capital equipment, you're investing in machinery and infrastructure to make these things work. But the question is, as we think about the modern parallels next week, does it require breaking up these companies and having a competitive marketplace, or does it just require a change in governance? Who owns it? Who benefits? And who makes the decisions for what objectives? That's the question to be thinking about. Again, there's more notes and links to a lot of the stuff that we talked about, as usual, at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode is released. We release that in a PDF every week. Rachel, thank you for being on, as always.
Thanks, Bill.